I call the House Committee on Rules to order. There is a quorum present, so let the record show that. And we're going to get right up and start with a public hearing on House Bill 3420. And with that, we'll have a short explanation by our administrator. I'm talking slowly because I don't see Jefferson Smith here yet. But hopefully he'll be here quickly. Okay, with that we can start.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3420 requires contracting agencies to evaluate bids or proposals for software procurement using the following criteria. One, the total cost of ownership. Two, job creation, use, and the retention of state funds within the state. Three, avoidance of dependence on a single vendor or supplier. And fourth, interoperability. It requires agencies to state reasons for choosing software and vendor or supplier and how the agency's choice reflects the criteria above in a notice of intent to award.
And we don't have, he's also testifying in another bill and another one, so we're going to leave this open. We've already heard that first portion. I would like him to have a chance to begin the testimony. And we're going to open another public hearing. He's also going to speak to that one. He's not there for here for that one. I don't want to get onto the other, so I guess we'll just take a short recess. I should have waited for a moment. Okay. House Bill 3420. I think we're also going to open a hearing on House Bill 3108, just so Representative Smith can get his testimony in on both of them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jefferson Smith, and I will find my testimony. I represent the 47th House District. At some point, Oregon will adopt legislation regulating campaign finance.
Go on back to, we're actually on your other two bills.
Are we on software procurement right now?
Correct.
That's an excellent point, Mr. Chair.
We actually moved it around
so that they would be first for you because we got information that would be helpful. So.
For the record, I would like to blame Representative Judy Stigler, who had some important points to make in Judiciary Work Session today that might have, well, they were important points, and I apologize to the members of the committee.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would point out because that I have frequently heard Representative Judy Stigler's important points, and they are always important to hear.
That's a good statement. And there's a number of people on this committee that drive across the state right afterwards, so we are appreciative of the time that we spend here until 5 o'clock. So.
The good news is, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I will be brief. Friend and business leader Brian Jameson came to me to encourage me to consider changes in how government buys software in order to save government money. As a member of, along with Representative Girard, the Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government, we have reviewed the budgets of government agencies and seen the huge bills that we pay on software and technology and how significant a portion of government expenditure within our agencies can be. Citizen Notes and Legislative Council's drafting produced this bill, and as Mr. Jameson spends his time running a business rather than spending his time as a lobbyist, today may be the first chance that he has had to be able to not to testify on this bill and communicate about it. I testify here to sound a soft alert for diligence in our technology procurement. Dugan Petty at DAS is doing some significant work. Representative Harker and I and others have had several meetings with agencies on the topic. I'm also aware that Oregon is a national leader in open source technology, and we'll have testimony on some of the ways this could help not only save money, but also spur our leadership in the field, so that this state can be a site not only of offshoots of important large companies, but also a site for headquarters of important technology companies. I ask this committee that we take this topic up in the interim. There will be testimony in opposition to the bill as drafted, and that's anticipated. Of course, any legislation that moves forward in this session, or much more likely next session, will need to take that feedback into account. And I do appreciate the committee taking the time to at least start the conversation now. And I think that was only about 2 minutes.
Would you like to also make a statement on House Bill 3108, the Patriot Dollar? We have a list.
For the record, Mr. Chair, I remain Jefferson Smith. I still represent the 47th District, although with my performance today, perhaps we're not as long as I would like. At some point, Oregon will get legislation regulating campaign finance. It might be that such legislation comes from a ballot initiative.
Oh. Patriot Dollar?
That's the Patriot Dollar.
Okay. I was thinking the other way, but you're
right. That's all right.
Okay.
No, I'm on purpose. I'm doing this on purpose.
Okay.
There might be advantage in having some of that come through our deliberative process. By way of background, I'm going to touch on the idea of limits to lead in to Patriot dollars. I know you're hearing that separately. And I do believe limits are an important piece of a campaign finance regime. Legislative races for a job that pays $20,000 per year. In competitive races, this last election cost over $1 million, adding them together. We had just individual candidates raise and spend nearly $700,000. That is more than twice what we were spending just 6 years ago. If we continue that trajectory, it will become even more obvious that regular people have less and less meaningful access to the electoral process. In 2008, of the $22 million donated to legislative candidates in Oregon, 7% of those donations came from donations of $100 or less. It is uncomfortable to acknowledge because each of us must raise money, and I do so without compunction. We call with pride money in politics as the mother's milk. But I also think we share an understanding that at some level, this can undermine the founding principle of one person, one vote. We should also be sure not to view limitation efforts as liberal schemes. They should be bipartisan efforts to work for reform. A few points on this. Republicans offered more support than Democrats in the most recent ballot initiative efforts on campaign finance reform. Republicans voted for that more often than Democrats did. I say this because I'm a Democrat, and I want to play against type, at least on this bill. In this state, unlike many other states, upper-income Oregonians lean Democratic just a bit, and Democrats have been raising more money than Republicans, at least in the most recent election. And it has been argued that the hunt for campaign dollars has contributed to the growth of government as fundraising politicians offer more carrots and sticks to the prospective donors. But ultimately, and I set aside some of the arguments that lend towards my own political party, but ultimately this should not be a matter of stratagem or winner picking, but a question of how we can best ensure that the public conversation yields the public interest. And we should not just weigh proposals in a vacuum, but compare them with the current system. Some of my own support for a broad array of reforms stems from my sense that a wide array of situations would be better than our current situation. I had my own bills on the topic of limits, largely as placeholders, and I think the state certainly should allow limits, and I applaud Janice Thompson and others for working good faith through the details. And I am here to testify on behalf of the Patriot Dollars idea, because at the same time, whenever reform laws work to restrict private money, at least two challenges are discussed. One, direct political debate is reduced. And two, the problem of the public conversation not yielding the public interest remains because the money might find its way by some other manner but outside the reporting regime. At the end of the day, you could buy a radio station. The Patriot Dollar Plan achieves equal opportunity without running the risks of more familiar reforms. You will see an article that we will get to the committee written by Yale Law Professor Bruce Ackerman, part of a sampling of a book written on the topic. Patriot Dollars, by contrast, promises more speech and more political competition. The idea, very simply, would be to give Oregonians, similarly to how we do now with political tax credit, but instead of a tax credit that very few Oregonians know exists, much less take advantage of, give people a credit card where they could apply that tax credit, or $5-$10 coupons where they could be collected so that more people would know about it and politicians would have and candidates would have more incentive to collect them. Patriot Dollars also removes two criticisms of traditional public financing regimes. First, the arbitrariness of how to choose which candidate gets support and how much they will get. In the nation, our public finance regime is based on nomination and matching, and our presidential candidates are starting to opt out. In the city of Portland and in several other states around the country, it is based either on a number of micro contributions like $5 or a certain number of signatures, and then after which you get an arbitrary amount of money. Although I think these are proposals worth considering, they are not elegant in terms of those arbitrary decisions. Second criticism is the mantra that we don't want government spending our money on politicians. Patriot Dollars would not have an arbitrary amount of contribution or an arbitrary mechanism, and further, it would be individuals themselves making the choices and directing their dollars. I recognize that additional tax credits or public subsidies, given the current fiscal picture, are challenging and perhaps unlikely. And so, like with the previous bill, really appreciate the committee at least opening the conversation, despite your really crowded docket, so that we can start facilitating a conversation about the idea. Beyond that, I will leave the even more vigorous advocacy for this idea to a man who's been making the case for at least 25 years, the Aviation Board Chair, former Umatilla County District Attorney, and interim member of this body, R.P. Joe Smith.
Thank you very much. Questions for this member? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we're going to go back and continue both of them being open. House Bill 3240, Mike Sachs and Jim Craven, if they would come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mike Sachs. I live in Eugene. I have a small software business in Eugene, and we sell both to government and to mostly a lot of businesses. I'm here to share some thoughts about House Bill 3420, which I believe has really excellent intentions, but there are some things that I do believe we should consider. First of all, I would really like to commend the author of the bill to put the total cost of ownership first and foremost on this bill of the items to be considered when purchasing software. As you know, there are many ways from a software company's point of view to sell your software or to make money using your software. You can sell it as a package, or you can give it away for free and make money on the services or the equipment that it's run on. Or there's now the software as a service model where you essentially rent out the use of your software. In a time where budgets are really tight, I believe it's very tempting for agencies to choose models where the cost of the software is pushed forward. The section is important to put first and foremost, but I do believe it might be useful to beef it up a little bit so that we consider the cost of the software and the hardware that it's run on and over the whole period of use of this software and not just the first 6 months or legislative session. The rest of this bill is, I think, has a lot of good items in it, but quite frankly, they, from a software vendor point of view in Oregon, might make my life a lot more complicated. As a small software company, the job creation bill, large software companies are even if they're out of state, can very easily, argue that a certain piece of software will create a lot of jobs. As a smaller company, number one, you're providing fewer jobs, and maybe you are not creating jobs, but you're just trying to maintain the jobs that you are providing right now. The clause about the single vendor or supplier, it makes us usually think about really large software companies, but I would like to point out that as smaller software companies, we tend to choose areas that provides very specialized solutions or niche areas of the market where we hopefully don't have too much competition, where we can actually, as a small company, have a chance to make a living. And so requiring alternative solutions in areas that are very specialized might pose a roadblock for providing our software. Then finally, the clause about shell evaluating bids and proposals for both commercial and non-commercial software is somewhat related to this previous item, where it's possible that there are only non-commercial or commercial solutions available, so the shell might be a little strong. And in addition to that, I do believe that it's important to, like I said before, to look at the big picture and make sure that even when we have really good intentions, this bill doesn't end up doing more harm than good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Craven representing Tech America. Since I haven't appeared before this committee, I have to remind you that Tech America is the successor organization to what you've known as AEA for all these years. We merged with another group the first of the year. So from now on, when I'm here, I will be Tech America instead of AEA, as I have been for the last 20 years. Tech America is the nation's largest trade association representing the high-tech industry, and we have a broad mixture of members both in producing electronic devices, software companies, and companies that build the backbone of the Internet. Included within our company are a number of software companies with a wide variety of business models, including companies that produce so-called proprietary software and companies that produce so-called open-source software. And I use the word so-called because in today's environment, lots have changed over the last several years, and the models and the definitions are constantly shifting. And distinctions that might have existed 6 to 10 years ago of a bright line between these different sources really have become mixed. And so the idea that there is one, you know, that software easily falls into one of these two camps is just really not quite reflective of the current realities. We do welcome Representative Smith's support for the software industry in Oregon. Oregon is among the top 10 states in the United States in terms of producing software products, and we have a number of prominent companies here at home. We respectfully disagree, however, that House Bill 3420 is a necessary addition to our state's public contracting statutes. You've heard some of the unintended consequences from the small business side. And our basic message is we believe that the state contracting agencies, including DAS, have the tools they need right now to really address the major points that are highlighted in this bill. You have my testimony. I won't read it at length, but we have an ORS that says DAS and state agencies shall look at software that's based on industry standards for open systems to the greatest extent possible. So we recognize in statute that we should buy stuff that can talk to each other. So we do have in statute that they should procure open systems that provide a vendor-neutral operating environment and software that operates together easily and reliably. I mean, these are actually words out of the ORSs. Finally, there's a note in this bill about encouraging the local software industry, and certainly we would encourage people who want to encourage the local software industry. Any of you who've gone through the hearings on public contracting know that this is a delicate dance, however. And in Oregon's public contracting statutes say that basically all other things being equal, fulfills the mission, price, suitability, public contracting agencies in Oregon may provide a preference to an Oregon firm. That's been it's delicate. You get into the providing hard preferences, and then you get into the retaliation from other states and such. So we have all things being equal, pick Oregon. It's okay to pick Oregon in the statutes, and we think that works well. In my conversations with the folks at DAS, I think they have the tools that they need to make wise decisions. I think those of you on Ways and Means should probably keep an eye on how all this works. But I really don't think this bill brings more to the tool kit than we currently have and could have some unintended consequences. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for either of these people? I want to thank you very much both for coming, and I think it was an interesting perspective between small business and a larger group, so I appreciate that very much. Thank you both.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Next, we have Brian Jamison. I hope I said that right.
Yeah. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Brian Jamison for the record. I am one of the founders of Open Sorcery, an Oregon-based firm. I also sit on the board of the Software Association of Oregon, and I'd like to talk about why I support this bill. The total cost of ownership is it's a technical term. It comprises about 12 different buckets, if you will, the costs of which go into software. Not all of these buckets have been explicitly laid out in the bill. That's some language we might consider to adjust. But I think it's important when evaluating any software procurement to take into account all of these buckets. Some of them require looking out on a longer time frame than I believe are currently being considered. Some of those buckets include software licenses and also license management, which has become a not insignificant cost as time goes on. And additionally, migration cost, not only from the existing system, but from the system that it will hopefully migrate to over time. I think it's important to have transparency, and for as an Oregon taxpayer, I would like to see this kind of information being brought forward and put in a public forum so that I can and others in my industry can see and reflect upon this information and assist our overburdened IT professionals in the state and help them with the information that they need, not only to calculate a proper TCO, total cost of ownership, but also to give them the other options that are out there that might not be apparent, that are not being advocated strongly for, because there are not well-aligned small niche companies or very large companies. It's this gray area that provides the largest possibility for savings in software, where there are no strong advocates and yet a clear solution. These solutions can save the state millions to tens of millions of dollars on an annual basis. They can provide jobs as a side benefit, and they represent a very real opportunity for the state. I recognize that although I've been in the software industry all my life and running companies all my life, I'm very new to this process, and I think there potentially needs to be some changes or small modifications made to things. I'd love to see that happen, but I do very much urge the committee to consider that this is a necessary step and an important step that we need to take, not just to increase transparency and interoperability of our existing systems, but also to provide our technology vendors an opportunity to get into what is a very difficult place to get into right now. So.
Any questions for our guest and witness? I don't see any right now. Recognize that this is not a group of people who got here because they wanted to understand IT a whole lot. And so we have a learning curve that's there. So we will be taking this up and talking to a lot of people before we make a final decision. But I appreciate you being here and coming forward to give us our explanation. So thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much for your time.
Is there anyone else in the room who wanted to speak to House Bill 3420? We had written it 3240, and so I just wanted to make sure that somebody missed the right place, so we're okay. Then I'm going to close our work session on House Bill 3420. We still have House Bill 30...
Public hearing,
I'm sorry. And that was the public hearing that I closed. We still have a public hearing on 3108 open, and I will call Joe Smith. We can do a short explanation, which we didn't do while Joe's coming up. So.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3108 establishes a Patriot Dollars Fund. This requires the Legislative Assembly to appropriate biennially an amount to the Patriot Dollars Fund no less than $50 multiplied by the number of registered electors in the state on January 1, the last year of the preceding biennium. Directs the Secretary of State to mail 50 Patriot dollars to each registered elector in the calendar year, allows electors to contribute those Patriot dollars to candidates for state or local elective office, allows candidates to submit the contributed Patriot dollars to the Secretary, back to the Secretary for payment from the Patriot Dollars Fund. It places limitations on the use of payments to candidates from the Patriot Dollars Fund, requires candidates who accept Patriot Dollars to limit all contributions in a calendar year to an aggregate amount not exceeding $500, directs the Secretary of State to purchase or otherwise secure broadcast or cable television time available for statewide and legislative candidates at primary and general elections, and directs the Secretary of State to publicize debates and forums by their candidates. It also repeals political tax credits. House Bill 2108 is one of several measures before the 2009 Legislative Assembly dealing with campaign finance reform. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, there are three main approaches to regulating campaign finance. Three primary methods are disclosure, contribution limits, and public finance. Most states utilize a combination of two or three. At the present time, Oregon relies primarily upon disclosure. Implementation of campaign finance limitations in Oregon would generally require passage of an appropriate constitutional amendment due to current legal interpretations of Oregon Constitution. House Bill 2108 takes a different approach by proposing a form of voluntary public financing of election campaigns.
And with that, welcome Senator Smith.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Joe Smith, and 5 years ago I had the privilege of, for a brief time, being a member of this body. But in many ways today is more meaningful to me because I am joining my son in supporting something that I deeply believe in. The thing that I deeply believe in is that the concept the framers of the Constitution gave us was right and should be allowed to work. There were two competing, and by the way, my remarks do not mirror what the statement that I gave. That statement takes about a minute, 20 seconds, and it ain't bad. But when the founding fathers, and of course, unfortunately, they were only fathers in those days, met to frame the Constitution, there were two competing views. One was that the people could not be trusted. The other was that the people could be trusted. They were both right in the correct concept, context. The people could not be trusted to make good decisions in the heat of the moment because the mob too easily took over. But ultimately, the people could and ultimately had to be trusted in the long run if you gave them the facts and gave them the time to debate and consider those facts and come to a reasoned decision. And so they came up with a Republican form of government, small r. Representative Jensen and I can remember, as little boys, when every year we gave our dimes to the March of Dimes. And every year we were told in the summertime we shouldn't go swimming in the public swimming pool. Representative Berger may dimly have told some of those stories, and if Representative Edwards and Reed were here, they wouldn't even know what I was talking about. Because those two gentlemen, Paul Polia was not on their chart. Those dimes that Representative Jensen and I contributed all went to buy iron lungs and to take care of people who had caught polio. And then two men came along and they invented, created, discovered something that attacked the root cause. And now children get a pill. Children now don't even know what polio is, don't recognize the word polio, because we addressed the root cause. Patriot dollars addresses the root cause, which is voter inattention, voter apathy, voter ignorance. And because of apathy and because of inattention and because of ignorance, candidates have to go where people are to get their attention. And where are they? Well, they're watching television. And to some extent, they read their mail. And so we send them slick 30-second or maybe occasionally 60-second spots, and we send them brochures in the mail and flyers in the mail, which are mostly pictures, which invite generalization and make it possible to say nothing but say it beautifully. So something needs to be done to change that voter mentality. Patriot Dollars gives every voter 50 apparent dollars, and they get it the first time. What is this? It's worth nothing. Oh, well, it is worth something if I give it to some candidate. To whom am I going to give it? Well, maybe before I decide the candidate I will give it to at any state or local election other than national, this will not go, Patriot dollars cannot go to federal candidates. Maybe I will give it to him or her or them, but before I do that, maybe I should learn a little bit about what they are for and who they are. How do I do that? Oh, well, I discover here in this thing I received from the Secretary of State, here is when I can go on television right in my own living room and listen to in-depth presentations by these candidates and these candidates who suddenly know there's liable to be a large audience on this television show realize they should take it seriously. And so they have to come and they have to talk maybe for 30 minutes and they can do it any way they want. But for 30 minutes, it's pretty hard to say nothing but say it beautifully and not be detected. It addresses the root cause. And then that voter has something of which to go, and then that television is not costing that candidate anything. Then not only do you reduce the need for those very expensive spots and those very expensive mailings, which drive the need to raise the $500,000 and the $700,000, which was raised by some candidates last time, because voters are paying attention. I'll close with this. When Abraham Lincoln and Douglas debated in Illinois, they never had fewer than 3,000 people. One time they had 20,000 people. And those people sat there for 3 hours and listened to what they had to say. Now candidates are told, you're lucky if you can get people's attention for 60 seconds. Well, if that continues to be true, if the public continues to pay less and less attention, we're going to discover that the framers' concept was wrong, that the sober second sense of the people can't be trusted. So we've got to address that root cause, and I submit that Patriot Dollars addresses that root cause. It solves the constitutional problem. It solves the problem of people feeling that their tax dollars are going to support somebody that they think is crazy, because their tax dollars are going to go only to support that person or persons whom they support. But most important, it addresses the root cause.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this witness? Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Smith. Just run through it for me for a second. The dollars are sent out. The videos are prepared. And based on the videos, the voters send their dollars to whoever they like. Then what happens?
Okay, first, there is no necessary connection between any video and the giving of the dollars.
Okay.
I suddenly have $50 and I look at it and realize I can't spend this, but it's a shame to have it go to waste. And I already know three or four candidates that I think are wonderful. I'll just go give it to them.
Okay.
But if I know nothing about them, then the next thought I have, gee, do I just throw these away? That seems like a dumb thing to do. So maybe I ought to learn. How do I learn? Well, there are lots of ways they might decide to learn. They might discover, for example, that these candidates who now know that if they talk to 50 people, they might get 40 of them each to contribute some portion of $50, makes it much more attractive to spend their time talking to those 40 people than to spend dialing for dollars, which, as you know, it takes an inordinate amount of time these days. And the higher the office, the more time you spend this way, and the less time you talk this way talking to the folks. Maybe they will go to their organization. Maybe they will start reading newspaper articles. But also, in addition, there will be provided time for candidates to in-depth address issues in a medium that we have not taken advantage of in a positive way. Television is a blessing and a curse. For politics, mostly, it has been a curse because it has reduced the depth of campaigns. But potentially, it is a huge blessing. Imagine what Abraham Lincoln could have done if he had had television. If he had been able to go on television and talk to all the folks.
Thank you.
Oh, any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Representative Smith, would you like to come up?
For the record,
is there anyone else? This is all the people who signed up for House Bill 3108. Is there anyone else that would like to speak before they can come up now? Come on up, Dan. Jefferson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jefferson Smith, District 47. In response to Representative Berger's question, I think that I'd offer three thoughts. First, we might consider the idea of an interim work group to sort of think about an idea like that. Obviously, we're not going to be, if we're cutting schools by blank number of days, we're not going to be spending additional money on, you know, trying to fix democracy, right? I get that. And as we do that, I think that we would want to ask questions about whether we think it's the voucher idea, not for schools but for politics, or whether it's a credit card idea like the Yale Law professors Ackerman and Ayers suggested. Third, I think we'd also want to consider this in light of the internet and how, you know, and how it was, do you go door to door to collect, or can you collect over the interwebs, a series of tubes? And I think that those are all things we could discuss in the interim.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Or did you want the other?
Well, you can go for it. You can add for Jefferson.
Well, that'll be kind of a generic question.
There. Okay, go ahead.
Representative Smith, I'm fascinated with the idea and the concept, and I think the greatest part about it is a serious attempt to get as Mr. Smith has so well identified the root cause. We so often in things we do try to treat symptoms and in the process do nothing as far as getting to the soft vaccine, of political campaigns. But the pessimist that I am on this, I'm wondering how do you keep these Patriot dollars from being sold?
Yeah, from being cheated. It's a good question, and I think in the interim, conversation we want to be had about fraud protections. I'd have a few responses from the hip. First would be, we have had very few, in fact, I don't know of just about any reported cases of actual election fraud, despite lots of fears and the fact that we mail out 300 ballots. Now, I understand that money isn't as obviously involved with ballots, so it's a different scenario, but I still think that's one, gives me some heart. Second, obviously there would need to be criminal protections in place that I actually think would be significant. And let's compare it to food stamps. Now, if there are food, and we know that people buy and sell food stamps. The difference here is that the person who bought and sold a Patriot buck and then transferred to a candidate, or if the candidate him or herself did, would be engaging in such a risk of their own campaign that I think very, very quickly we would see, I think it would be very unlikely to see intelligent candidates run that risk. The risk I could imagine that doesn't seem frivolous is not the candidate him or herself doing it, and maybe not the candidate's campaign him or herself doing it, but private firms who went out and said, oh, we're going to collect all of these and we're going to take a cut of the deal. And I think in the regulations, you'd have to make sure that not only was that either prohibited, or it would just be so obviously the liability and criminal liability would so obviously inure to the candidate him or herself that, again, even I think we just wouldn't even see the hiring of such a private, of such private firms. So those are a few thoughts. I think that would be something we'd need to consider. I think it's a really important question, but the whiff of it would mean you wouldn't win. So why would you want the money?
Mr. Chair, yes. I might respond.
Yes.
Jensen, the bill specifically prohibits that. The bill also requires that the person turning in the chit give his or her name, occupation, and address with the chit. So, for starters, somebody who comes in with 10 or 20 or 30 of these things is immediately suspect, and the candidate, as Representative Smith has indicated, is in huge jeopardy accepting those, because if he or she accepts them, they are in deep doo-doo in more ways than one. And so I think what he said is very, very appropriate. And, of course, having been a district attorney, I will never suggest that you can do anything to keep people from doing something illegal if they think they're going to make money on it. But the threat here is it's going to happen in such a small, small way that the risk is minimal.
Okay. Berger, did you have a... Okay.
Mr. Meek.
Thank you. Dan Meek. I represent groups including Fair Elections Oregon, which was the committee, the group that put measures 46 and 47 on the ballot in 2006. I don't recall seeing this on the committee's schedule, House Bill 3108, but having read it, I would very enthusiastically endorse it. I think it's a great idea. It may appear to cost $100 million, that is $50 times 2 million registered voters. But I think it would cost easily less than half that, because the state and local campaigns in the last election cycle are documented to have cost over $70 million anyway. That's kind of an indirect tax on corporations and union members. The money does come from somewhere. So this, I think, would, to a large degree, substitute for that money and would not cost a new $100 million. Second, however, I think it does need a slight improvement. It forbids any candidate from accepting a contribution in an aggregate amount exceeding $500 from a single person or political committee in a calendar year if they accept the CHITS. In Oregon, it takes about 2 minutes and $0 to create a political committee. So I would imagine that the various caucuses would form 10 political committees or 100 political committees, and therefore the effective limitation on an individual's contribution to a person, even if all the individuals use the CHITS, could be increased to 5,000 or 50,000 or just about any number that you would want. So I would say let's just change that to a candidate may not accept contributions in an aggregate amount exceeding $500 from a person that defined as an individual or human being, period. That's it. About enforcement, I think you would also want the person who's using the CHIT to fill it out with his or her phone number. It would then be pretty easy to do a random check, call up people, and say, gee, who did you contribute that? Who did you contribute your CHIT to? If they don't know, then investigate further. Also, on the CHIT, you could require the person to write the name of the candidate being contributed to and assign the CHIT. I mean, then you can do some checks on that, and I think the criminal aspect of this is manageable, and I think it's a great idea.
Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, yes, Representative Jensen.
In relationship to this, what does this do to the independent expenditures?
Good question. I will say this and then defer to the principal bill drafter, and both people to my right have insight that I might not have. One of the things I like about this concept is that rather than focusing on how to ratchet down spending, thinking that we're going to be able to cap speech in exactly the right way or cap financing exactly the right way, that we will get the small d Democratic results or small r Republican results we hope for, that it encourages more people to participate in donating. So my hunch is that it has, and I'd need to look again at the details of the bill to be sure of this, that it would have no direct impact on independent expenditures at all, but might have the indirect and very important impact of diluting them so that, and not by, I don't mean that with a D fooling, but with a T weakening, so that they weren't as powerful because more people were participating in a direct way, in a reported way, in a transparent way, in a small dollar way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that is correct. This bill does not directly address that problem. If I were able to play God, I would add to this bill a requirement that any independent expenditure be required to report where its money came from and what it spent through a public process. So it would not limit that right at all, so you don't have the constitutional problem, but would give transparency to it. We didn't try to put that in this bill, but I think it is correct. As long as you have a constitution that says free speech is something that we like, there is always going to be a problem in telling somebody that he or she can. I'll give you a simple example. Suppose in October there's suddenly 30 billboards in a city show up that say, we have this problem, we have this problem, we must save our city for the future. And the day before filing deadline, a very attractive candidate that nobody's ever heard before suddenly announces, those billboards are right. I believe that we should do this, this, and this, and save our city for the future. No correlation between those billboards and that candidate that's observable. I don't think constitutionally you can do much about that. I think you have another problem. Suppose there are 7 candidates for an office. And an independent person goes out and says, candidate X is a louse. Well, one of the things that's been tried is to say that person saying that candidate's a louse has to have some permission from the other candidate. Which of the 6 candidates is he or she supposed to get permission from? There are just so many, many problems. I'd also like to say I am delighted that Mr. Meek is here today. I had no idea he was going to be here, but he has studied these kind of problems for a long time, and I'm delighted to hear that he likes the idea.
Representative Jensen, of course, you'll be hearing a bill after this, 3009, that does, for example, ban independent expenditures by all corporations and unions, and, of course, there also limits contributions by everyone. I think with this, with the Patriot Dollars bill, there is a slight chicken and egg problem. That is, if you don't have any limits on contributions and expenditures to begin with, then nothing would prevent, let's say, me running as a candidate from accepting a third of a million or more contributions from each from corporations or unions or wealthy individuals or whatever, and those amounts are not certainly not unheard of in Oregon politics. And developing a war chest and then spending $1 million on television ads that say, once you get your Patriot dollars, I'm the populist candidate, I'm going to stick it to everybody. So if you don't have limits on contributions or independent expenditures to begin with, I think there would be some distortion of the destination of the Patriot dollars. So I think this would work well with limits on contributions and independent expenditures.
Thank you very much for that. The only question I had is, has anybody tried a Patriot dollar issue anywhere in the country yet?
Haven't.
Okay.
Big so bottle bill.
Thank you very much. And we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3108, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3009. With that, we'll have Janice Thompson come up, and we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3009 makes findings and declarations regarding the need for campaign finance reform and candidate contribution limits. It sets limits on amounts that may be contributed by individuals, political committees, or other persons, small donor committees, and candidates to political candidates and political committees. It prohibits direct contributions by corporations and labor organizations, provides civil penalties, establishes the personal liability of the candidate and candidate's treasurer for penalties by the candidate and the candidate's principal campaign committee, establishes liability for directors of political committees for political committee other than principal political committee offenses. It requires the identification of sources for political publications, defines labor organization and small donor committee for purposes of chapter ORS chapter 260, modifies deadlines for filing independent expenditure reports, and becomes operative if an amendment to the House, to the Oregon Constitution proposed in House Joint Resolution 26 for 2009, allowing the regulation of campaign contributions, is approved by the people at the next general election. Campaign finance reform is the subject of several measures before the 2009 Legislative Assembly. Such matters have also been before the Legislative Assembly in previous legislative sessions. Implementation of campaign finance limitations in Oregon would generally require passage of an appropriate constitutional amendment due to current legal interpretations of Oregon Constitution. House Bill 3009 expressly provides that it becomes operative only on adoption of a proposed constitutional amendment set forth in House Joint Resolution 26.
Thank you very much. And with that, Janice.
With Democracy Reform Oregon. I want to cover three concepts or big picture parts of the testimony. The problem, kind of a policy solution, and a little bit on the politics. One of the documents provided is a resource on money in Oregon politics, historical information, and kind of linking how money is flowing to the reform options. So I just want to just touch base on, if you flip to page one, just highlight some of the key findings. I think the basic backdrop for mapping out this data is a reflection that the system is broken and that folks kind of are good people, you know, elected officials are good folks who are kind of stuck in that problematic system. So fundraising totals continue to climb consistently at a rate higher than inflation, and one of the key elements there is that that's likely to intimidate potential candidates. Pretty like, what, this is how much I have to raise? Large contributions donate to fundraising. This undermines public trust, and there are definitely, I mean, the largest single contribution I think that I can recall is $2 million. To a 2006 gubernatorial candidate from one entity. And many other raising contribution levels in six figures. In this finding, I actually specifically did not include that, like, those big dollars, but rather put it in the terms of just consistently how much money is coming as a percentage of total contributions in these large contributions. And so this average for over four legislative cycles is that in the general election, 71% of the money is coming in checks, not just of 1,000 and more, but 1,001. So it's just a much more systemic problem. It's easy to kind of like, oh, you know, focus on these really, really big ones. But I think looking at the domination of large contributions of fundraising in terms of just how much, you know, the money is coming in, 5,000, 10,000, 20. At times, these contributions then make up very large percentages of the total fundraising, and again, undermining public confidence and raising the possibility of perceived corruption. I think in Oregon, we're lucky to live in a state where I would say, you know, there's no quid pro quo politics going on overall. But when somebody is elected for office and they get over 50% of their total fundraising from one source, it just raises the real possibility that people will perceive it raises eyebrows. Let's put it that way. Donations of $100 or less, the miscellaneous contributions, unitemized, are definitely overshadowed by the large money. The number of Oregonians who contribute to candidates in these state races is, you know, a tiny percentage of everybody out there. So those are some of the key findings, I think, just really illustrate the extent to which things are getting a little out of control and there's a problem. In terms of the legislation, it starts with the findings section. This is recommended by the Brennan Center for Justice. And I just want to, in general, identify this bill as a starting point for discussion. It was vetted by this group. They put out this, you know, big writing reform. And I can't say I've read every word, but I've read most of them. But there, it's particularly, as the explanation mentioned, to get limits in Oregon, there is the need to amend the Oregon Constitution. But the federal First Amendment doesn't go away. And so, in particular, worked with the Brennan Center folks to vet the bill to make sure that it doesn't just run into problems in the federal courts. So, and one of the things they recommend are findings. There are some amendments, including some amendments to some of the numbers, which is a reflection that I had to come up with some numbers before the big report was, you know, finalized. So, and the limits then, in Section 3, I think should be viewed then as a floor. If you go lower than that, I think there's an increased likelihood you will just run into problems at the federal. There are pass-through restrictions, candidate to candidates, limit to $1,000, transfers between political party and other PACs are limited to $2,500. There is a small donor PAC provision. They are found in California and Colorado. And This is a concept that's, you know, again mentioned in by the Brennan Center as something to really take a look at to improve opportunities for small donor. And it's, again, the data illustrates that those people are just getting kind of left out of the picture. Now, one policy question, if the bill moves forward, is, as written, an organization could have both kind of a regular candidate, related PAC and a small donor PAC. That's not how it's set up in California, and so that would be one of the policy things to think about. Is it, you know, is on that? I think I really support the concept of the small donor PAC, but, you know, whether or not it's in here quite right is would be a topic for future discussion. Something else that the bill does is, let me just kind of keep going through section by section. Section 4, you do need to address the potential for the proliferation of political committees to get around, to prevent circumvention. So that is factored in Section 4. In Section 5, as has been found constitutional at the federal level, contributions from Treasury dollars of both unions and corporations are banned. And again, this ban is constitutional because these groups can form affiliated PACs. So they're, they have a whole other vehicle. Ballot measures are not addressed in this. This is just focuses on candidates. However, to avoid initiative or ballot measure committees from being a way to kind of, again, get around the candidate contribution limits, this sets up kind of an iron wall between the candidate world and the ballot measure world. Penalties are provided. They have a civil penalties focus, something, again, that's recommended by the Brennan Center for Justice. Now, one of the other more special features of this particular legislation compared to elsewhere are that the limits, though they apply to loans, cash, in-kind contributions, they are nudged up for in-kind contributions. And in talking, before I introduced that idea, I again had conversations with the Brennan Center folks, and this is a, constitutional idea. And there's two ways to do it. One way is what's in here, which is to nudge it up a little bit and just say that it applies to all in-kind contributions. The goal is to facilitate the more volunteer kinds of activities that groups, they spend staff time arranging a phone bank or a door-knocking day. All that volunteer activity isn't reported and wouldn't be affected by the limits. But those groups, report and would be affected by the limits, the staff time to kind of do that setup work. So the notion of, nudging the in-kind contributions up is really intended to facilitate that. As written, however, the nudging up applies to any in-kind contribution. So another way to go is to nudge it up potentially more, but to be more targeted and say it only applies to these independent in-kind contributions. So again, those were the two ways in talking with the Brennan Center folks to kind of get at this, and future discussion could be warranted on, did the way that I picked to kind of go in the bill, is that the right way to do it? Section 8, many of you and many campaigns, other campaigns, continue to label campaign materials with a paid-for by identification, but that actually is no longer in state law. So this just kind of restores that. Independent expenditures are banned if they come from corporate and union treasury dollars. However, because that's been found constitutional at the federal level. However, federal courts have not upheld other limits on independent expenditures. And so, again, in trying to have a bill that keeps within the paradigm of the federal level, those aren't addressed. However, there is prompt time reporting of the independent expenditures. And then the bill does only go into effect, you know, if the accompanying constitutional amendment moves in. So just a little bit then on the politics. I see this as something that the legislature could move on and prove skeptics wrong. I think, you know, conventional wisdom is that legislators or elected officials are not going to take action that would so directly affect how they got to office in the first place or future elections. And I'm more positive than that. And I think it's could be a very kind of pro-legislative branch action to take on a proactive basis. And would urge your consideration of House Bill 3009.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. Is there any questions? None yet. It's a lot to absorb. But thank you very much. Next, we have Norman Terrell and Kathy Eaton. Two at a time.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Norman Turrell. I'm here today representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I should also point out that I'm also a member of the National Board of the League of Women Voters. The League of Women Voters is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. The League has long advocated improving election campaigns by limiting campaign contributions. To accomplish this, the League supports HB 3009. A constitutional amendment will also be needed to be referred to the voters to allow this bill to be effective. With the April signing of contribution limits bill by the governor of New Mexico, Oregon is one of only four states without some sort of campaign contribution limits. The League believes that our legislators and other office holders are honest and hardworking. However, they are caught in a bad campaign finance system that demands ever-increasing contributions and expenditures to win elections. This makes them dependent on huge campaign contributions from interest groups that appear to want undue influence and access. A tipping point in Connecticut's decision to adopt its citizens' election program in 2005 was a scandal that sent its governor to prison. New Mexico adopted its contribution limits legislation when motivated by scandals involving the Secretary of State, the State House Speaker, and a former Senate President pro tem. There are many other examples of a pattern of scandal leading to reform.
But the League of Women Voters believes that
we can do better in Oregon. HB 3009 provides a solution for the troubling increases in fundraising and the domination of larger and larger contributions. The League's question for you today: will it take another scandal for the legislature to adopt campaign finance reform for our election system? The League certainly hopes not, and we believe that the motivation should be to improve our election system, not to react to some scandal. We urge the committee to seriously consider HB 3009 for passage to the House floor. Thank you very much for your attention today.
Thank you very much. Ms. Eaton.
This afternoon by this time, almost evening. Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, today I'm representing the American Association of University Women of Oregon. AUW advances equity for women and girls through advocacy, education, and research. Our public policy positions, which reflect member agreement, encompass education, government, and social services. We've been concerned over the last 20 years for the problems with escalating costs of electing public officials, particularly the Oregon legislature. AUW supports House Bill 3009 and limits for the political contribution which it proposes. I want to talk a little bit about AUW's experience with campaign reform. We really put our feet on the ground, as it were, in the 1993-94 campaign for campaign finance reform, when our members became aware that the costs of increasing running for the House in Oregon went from $3,000 in 1974 to $30,000 in 1992. In 18 years, we'd had tenfold. It was tenfold. Well, thank you. It was tenfold, and that was that brought our attention to the fact that something which we felt was undemocratic was really happening. That the costs of running for election were getting beyond what we considered our citizen legislature. And we needed to look at it. So we have branches across the state, in eastern Oregon, in central Oregon, from Portland to Ashland, and on the coast. And our members put their feet on the ground, passing petitions for that initiative in 93-94, when 72% of the electorate passed that initiative. That told us that people in Oregon were really interested in doing something about the costs of elections. And unfortunately, that was overturned by the Supreme Court in 1997. So in 2000, we looked again at an initiative that was going to do something about limiting expenses and campaign finance. And again, our volunteers passed petitions to get that measure on the ballot. Well, it's 9 years later, and we're still having a problem, and we really feel that it behooves the legislature to take a look at who it is that is actually putting the money into campaigns and electing people to public office in Oregon. And as that report from Democracy Reform shows you, the escalation in our consideration is almost obscene in terms of what it costs now to run for a $20,000 a year job in the legislature representing the people of Oregon. So we really hope that you will take a serious look at 3009 and take literally the bull by the horns so that the legislature recognizes and says it's time to do something. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you both. And our last two people who have signed up, Henry Kramer and Dan Meek.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Henry Kramer. I represent the bus project. First off, I want to thank you for being here at 4:45 on a Friday. And as I recall coming in here at about noon, it was sunny outside. I hope it still is, and when you get out, it will remain sunny. Today I'm testifying in favor of House Bill 3009, although there are several things we'd like to improve if the bill is to move forward. I'll address those in just a little bit. In the opinion of the bus project, our democracy weighs under the excessive influence of big dollar donations on elections. Since 2002, we've had thousands of volunteers knocking over 250,000 doors in the state of Oregon, and organizations like ours connect excited individuals to inspiring candidates such as yourselves, and it's that sort of person-to-person contact on the doorstep, on the phones, that really enriches our republic and makes it great. And when individual voters can have a conversation with other Oregonians about their elected officials that helps build trust in those officials and in the process itself. And with that in mind, I want to focus my testimony on why campaign finance in general helps build trust in our levers of government and on those portions of 3009 that would enrich our democracy through the increased power of volunteers and small donors in our political process. At the bus, we're fond of a saying that democracy is made possible by good people doing good things for no good reason. Today's campaign finance problem is that too many people see our democracy as calculating people doing transactional things for subpar or selfish reasons. This simplistic belief is not the opinion of the bus project, but it is something we hear on the doorstep with an alarming frequency. And a smart campaign finance reform system, a measured system, could avoid even the appearance of political corruption. And for legislators to self-impose limits would most likely represent to most Oregonians little short of a political miracle and would go far toward building confidence, extreme confidence, in the fine work you all do here. I'd like to focus on Section 3, Part 3, the limits pertaining to small donor political action committees. By significantly raising the limits of a committee can give if all of its donations come from individuals giving less than $100, we can strongly incentivize the seeking of small contributors, empower average Oregonians, and rightly give more political power to those organizations that have a broad membership, and we're strongly supportive of those elements of House Bill 3009. And I would also like to direct your attention to Section 7, Part 2, which, as Janice rightly pointed out, creates a higher ceiling for in-kind contributions. And we applaud the effort to distinguish between dollars given and time given. Just imagine the difference between a check written by a business and the free time given by the employees of that business to a candidate. It simply changes the way we think about the way that we do our democracy. And by institutionalizing that difference, we can genuinely improve both the perception and the political process and its execution. But if this bill is to move forward, we would strongly urge you to further distinguish, as Janice was talking about, between staff time given towards volunteers for a candidate and other forms of in-kind contributions, such as lawn signs or direct mail or television ads. And it's our opinion that while volunteers are priceless and energy going toward organizing them can hardly be seen as having any particular corrupting influence, the same thing can't be said for other kinds of in-kind contributions. And if that distinguishing language is to be put in, we would also suggest raising the limit just to allow for sort of that staff time spent. And we're very encouraged by the attention being given to this issue and hope to continue the conversation over the next weeks, months, and years, and hopefully end up with a smart and measured campaign finance system that diminishes the influence of huge dollar donations and really empowers hands-on democracy. And thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions, although I imagine you're interested in getting out of here.
Thank you. Mr. Meek.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dan Meek. I represent Fair Elections Oregon, which is the group that put ballot measure 47 on the ballot in 2006 and got it passed. I've handed out several things. They unfortunately don't have my name on them, so I'll identify them during the testimony. One is a set of three charts that illustrates the existing political system, the system of campaign finance that was adopted by the voters in Measure 47, and my best interpretation of House Bill 3009. I could highlight just a couple of the differences. In the current Oregon political system, you'll see that in the lower left-hand corner of the chart, it says all lines represent unlimited money. And you can see that all of the lines on the chart represent unlimited money. That is, in the current Oregon system, contributions can come from essentially anywhere can go essentially anywhere. And they can be spent in any manner, either given to the candidate or through independent expenditures, and that money can even be spent on luxury trips to meet with lobbyists or campaign contributors to pay friends and relatives for their services, to take trips to Hawaii, et cetera. That's the existing system. And Norm Terrell said that there were four states with no limits on on contributions. In fact, there are only two, Oregon and Missouri. And curiously enough, in both states, the citizens of both states enacted strict campaign finance limitations by initiative, which neither of which are in effect today. In the case of Oregon, it's simply because the Attorney General and Secretary of State are not enforcing them. We have sued the Secretary of State and Attorney General. We're currently in the Court of Appeals on that case. Measure 47 shows the limits established by Measure 47. The notable part of that really is the small donor committee. And you'll notice that all of the lines emanating from...
Yep. Oh, it came out earlier. You should have it in your packet.
I also brought 50 copies with me.
It's in the first packet.
the packet was our desk when we came.
Thank you.
Okay. Most notable element, small donor committees. You'll note that there's no limit on what small donor committees can spend, but there is a strict limit on what they can accept. They can only accept contributions from individuals and only in amounts of $50 a year. That kind of grassroots committee we thought would be a small D democratic use of money, and that they could then contribute or spend the money in any way they desired, because the money was all coming from individuals in very small amounts. House Bill 3009, the one that you're considering today, the notable difference between it and Measure 47 is that there is no aggregate limit on contributions by individuals in House Bill 3009. I'll get into that in a second. And there is also no limit, no restriction on how money, campaign money, can be spent, apart from the existing system, which does allow campaign money to be spent for purposes that seems to raise a lot of public concern. In addition, House Bill 3009 does limit what small donor committees can do with the funds that they collect. Even though those are funds from small donors, there are rather severe restrictions on what small donor committees can do in House Bill 3009. Now, a couple of features of 3009 that haven't been mentioned are on the last page of 3009, Section 13 in particular. Section 13 repeals Measure 47, enacted by Oregon voters in 2006. Now, in your discussions about the initiative process, folks have often wondered, why do initiative sponsors want to put their measures in the Constitution? Well, this is the reason, because we now have a bill before you to repeal what the voters enacted just 3 years ago. And I'm surprised this hasn't been mentioned. In addition, of course, this bill itself says it does not become operative until House Joint Resolution is approved by the people. And House Joint Resolution, as far as I know, it hasn't been scheduled for a hearing. And maybe it will, maybe it won't. On this bill itself, I passed out also a handout that describes four what I consider to be very severe problems with it that would essentially render the limits ineffective. The first problem I mentioned is that there's no aggregate limit on individual contributions in this measure. Instead, there's a limit of any individual can contribute $2,500 to any one political committee other than a principal campaign committee. That's in the primary and general separately, so it's essentially $5,000 to any political committee in an election season. We already have thousands of political committees. It takes 5 minutes to create one. So, in essence, what this bill would do is not limit individual contributions, but would instead cause the proliferation of political committees so that it becomes even more difficult to trace contributions back to individuals. You have to go through yet another step. I think this would make the bill completely ineffective. I note in the handout that Measure 47 enacts a aggregate limit on individual contributions of $2,500 a year. That is effectively the same limit that Maryland has, and I list another 10 or 11 states plus the District of Columbia that have aggregate individual limits, which are absolutely critical, particularly when it's so easy to form a political, so easy and inexpensive to form a political committee. The second problem is that anyone can evade the limits in 3009 by creating a person other than an individual, such as a club. If you look carefully at the language, you will see that this bill is structured in the opposite way as Measure 47. Measure 47 says everything is banned except what we specifically allow. This bill, in contrast, only has specific limitations. And it happens, if you read it carefully, that there are no limitations on what is done by an association, a club, or an other combination of individuals having collective capacity, as long as it's not a corporation. So any club can form, any association can form, they can do anything that they want, receive money and contribute money in an unlimited way. Third, this bill does not provide what's called the MCFL exception. It's named after the Massachusetts Citizens for Life case of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1986. which says that if you want to limit independent expenditures by corporations and unions, that's what this bill does in Section 5. It prohibits independent expenditures by from corporate or union treasuries, that you have to explicitly make an exception for a certain kind of nonprofit corporation. There's specific language in Measure 47 that does this. That's Measure 47, Section 2X. And there is no such language in House Bill 3009. I would then therefore expect that the ban on independent expenditures by corporations and unions would be struck down by the federal courts under the U.S. Constitution. And finally, in 3009, the U.S. Supreme Court has also held that you've got to have language establishing that corporations and unions can establish separate segregated funds to accept contributions from certain categories of individuals. Measure 47, Section 7, includes the language that has been required by U.S. Supreme Court decisions, but House Bill 3009 does not. So I think adopting 3009 as written would adopt ineffective limits on contributions and expenditures. I believe it would leave open essentially the system the way it is today, because various parts of it would be struck down as inconsistent with the U.S. Constitution, and other parts simply allow unlimited contributions but in another form through the proliferation of political committees. And I think that if the legislature adopted this bill, it would not prove the critics wrong. It would prove the critics right, because legislatures in other states sometimes adopt bills called campaign finance reform that really aren't. Thank you.
Any questions for Dan? I have one. Dan, on section, doesn't section 4, it says all political committees established by the same corporation or its subsidiaries are treated as a single committee. So they, and then farther on, labor organizations, the same issue. I mean, basically, you can't go out and make a whole lot of new ones.
Under House Bill 3009, any individual can form a political committee.
Okay. So that would, the corporations couldn't do a whole lot, but they could have every member in the corporation form one or whatever.
That's correct. In addition, of course, if you wanted to go to the extra step, you could pay $50 to form a corporation, and that corporation could form a political committee. But there's no reason to go to the extra step since every individual can also form a political committee.
Thank you. Any further questions for either of these witnesses? Seeing none. We have no one else signed up. There's only one other person in the room. He doesn't seem to be standing ready to come this way.
I can go out in the hall.
So we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3009. And committee, I have scheduled that we will not have a meeting next Friday. We've been working every day these last few weeks. This next week is going to be busy for a whole lot of the other committees that kind of end when it happens. So hopefully someone else can use that time this time if they wish to finish up the business that they need to do. So we won't. We do have schedules for the other two states. Any other questions or thoughts? Is there anything else you want to think of?
No.
Okay. Then we're going to close our committee on rules for today.